Well, everybody, welcome to this week's installment of Supernatural Beings. We will be looking into several specific beings that definitely existed. As far as what they currently exist or not is a separate question, which we'll hopefully get into. So let's get started. Okay, so the title is based on the Harry Potter book. But we will unfortunately not be covering books from the Harry Potter universe due to the fact that they're a little too beyond reality for me. So here we are. Okay, so we're going
Good
to be
evening.
Focusing on, what was that?
Good evening.
Thanks. Okay, so yeah, and everybody, feel free to unmute if you have any questions or get any point. So we're going to be discussing four animals. In various degrees of depth. The most time will be given to the Tahash and the Ra'im, thanks to their prominently being displayed both in the both of this week's Parsha, or at least the Tahashes, and the fact that the Ra'im is mentioned quite a few times in Tanakh. Then we'll hopefully, if we have time, we'll hopefully have a short piece on the Koi and the Shamir. Okay, so we're going to talk about those four animals. What are they? A little bit about how they come up in Jewish literature, and then And then hopefully we'll all walk away on a little bit more. So again, so there's points we want to know about each of them. We hopefully want to find some idea of what they look like, where can we find them if we can, and also we want to see, you know, why do we care about these animals? Like why are we spending time learning about them? So before I actually get into it, I noted that I'm only picking four. So if you want to read more on both on some more of the fantastical animals or the actual animals that you can find in the zoo, I highly recommend Rabbi Dr. Natan Slifkin's books as well as his museum, where you can find both the fantastical ones as well as the ones that are currently alive and kicking. So again, feel free to follow that link for his books as well as to his museum. Again, a lot of the information I have to take from was from him. If it's taken from another source, I will mention that where I got it from as well. Somebody wants, again, the slideshow. I will be posting at the end. If somebody wants to make sure that they, you know, get the recording and everything afterwards, please feel free to send me an email. Either type your email in the chat, or you should have it anyways. I'll post it in the chat as well. Okay. So now let's talk about the Tahash. So for this, right, so I'm sure everybody has hopefully heard it or at least read it preparing for this week's Parsha Truma. When we're describing the Beit HaMikdash, so prominently displayed within it is the final covering on top of the rest of the whole Mishkan is made up of Tahash skins. So what is a Tahash? So somebody, I believe Izzy's the one who requested specifically make sure we cover the Tahash. So if you could please read the two of the very important sukkim about Tahash that we're going to be utilizing.
And and ram skin dyed red, and Tahash skins and acacia wood. I clothed you with embroidered garments and gave the sandals of Tahash to wear and wound fine linen around your head and dressed you in silks.
Okay, so based on what we've read so far, what does it seem like Tahash is? Like, what is it made out of and what is it used for?
It was used for covering the Mishkan.
Right, it's used for covering the Mishkan, but like what type of material would you say it is based on what we've read so far?
Skins of
hide
animals.
Leather.
Hide or leather. Right, that's what we're all thinking. Based on, you know, it's put right next to ram's leather, it's used for making shoes, right? Seems like some sort of leathery type substance, right? The question is, but what else? So as far as its usages, so as I mentioned, it's used for covering the Mishkan, right, over the whole Mishkan, but it's also used for covering various parts of the Mishkan while it is in motion, such as the Aron Shulchan Mizbeach, as you see in the beginning of Bamidbar. And again, as we mentioned, it's also seemingly perhaps the fanciest shoe you ever will have. So that's all. That's very nice. Then all we still don't know what under the tachash is. So for that, don't worry. You're not the only one who's confused. The Gemara is also very confused as to what a tachash is. Okay, so we're going to be reading here. I have in front of us is the Talmud Bavli in the second Shabbat about the tachash. We're also going to have the see the Yerushalmi in a little bit as well, trying to figure out what exactly is the tachash. Okay, so we're going to need a couple of readers. So again, if you feel comfortable, simply. So we're gonna have somebody read the first paragraph and read the second paragraphs. So again, so if volunteers, if you please, feel free.
Have I ever raised an objection?
Who's raising an objection?
Yeah.
Yes, Robert's objection. I saw that Ralph. Well, unless you have to unmute yourself if you want to read. I saw that he wanted to. Ralph, can you unmute yourself?
Who's going to read?
So I thought Ralph raises. Ralph, you have to unmute yourself. I'm trying to. You have to. Okay, so here, yeah, asking you to unmute. Okay, it looks like if you're having technical difficulties, I guess we'll have to have another volunteer. Hopefully we'll get it sorted out and you'll have a chance to read later. Okay. Okay, so the word of the Mark. Yeah, go for it, Mark.
Rabbi Abba raised an objection. Rabbi Yehuda says there were two coverings of the tabernacle, one made of the reddened hides of rams and one of the hides of tchashim. Rabbi Nechemiah said there was only one covering of the tabernacle, half of which was made of ram's hides and half of the hides of tchashim. And tchashim were similar to the species of undomesticated animals called tela'idan. The Gemara asks, but isn't a tela'idan a non-kosher creature? The Gemara amends the statement. That is what Rabbi Nechemah intended to say. It was like a tela'idan in that it was multicolored. However, it was not an actual tela'idan. Ilan. There, the tel ilan is non-kosher, and here, the covering of the tent was made from kosher animals. Rav Yosef said, if so, that's the reason that we translate the word tachash as sasgona, which means that it rejoices, sas, in many colors, givanim.
Very good. Okay, so now, what do we see so far? From what we've read until now from this first part of the Gemara, what do we seemingly know about the tachash? We see several things. You know, it's similar to an animal called the tela'ilan, which we're going to see in a little bit. It's called the jene. We know that it's multicolored. We know that the tachash, on the other hand, is kosher, and we also know that it has many colors. Okay, I think I cut out there for a second. So again, so we know that it has many colors. We know that it is going to be a kosher animal. And we know that it looks similar to this animal called the tela'ilan. So, right, so based on that, that's where we start our starting point that we can work off of. So now it sounds like it's very easy to find this animal. Of course, it should be easy enough. You know, figure out the animals that look like this other animal, and then we'll have our tachash. But that's not quite the case, as we see in the next paragraph, because there's a dispute. So somebody likes to read the next part. Yeah. So Ralph, try and unmute yourself. You have to click the button on the screen to unmute. Click the little thing that looks like a microphone.
I got it. Is that all right?
Yeah, I can hear you. Go for it. From the Gemara asks.
The Gemara asks, what is the halachic conclusion reached about this matter of the tachash that existed in the days of Moses? Rav Ila said that Rav Shimon ben Lakish said that Rav Meir used to say the tachash that existed in the days of Moses was a creature unto itself, and the sages did not determine whether it was a type of undomesticated animal or a type of domesticated animal, and it had a single horn on its forehead. And this tachash happened to come to Moses for the moment while the tabernacle was being built, and he made a covering for the tabernacle from it. And from then on, the tachash was suppressed and is no longer found.
Okay, so from this part of the Gemara, can I go outside and cast myself a tachash? Nope. But we found something else about it, though, from this story. It mentions that it had a single horn.
Horn, yeah.
Right? So right. That's gonna be a useful fact. Okay, so now we know many colors, as well as it having a unique horn on its head. Okay, so that's one data point.
Either a unicorn?
Sounds like a unicorn or a rhinoceros. Right? Sounds like it's got one horn. Sounds like it's a unicorn.
Or a rhinoceros.
It could be. We'll see. Okay, so that's one data point we have, right? That's the Gemara Shabbat as in the Talmud Bavli. Now we have the parallel Gemara and the Talmud Yerushalmi.
All right.
Okay, so you got to talk about the same issue of whether or not you were allowed of making the making building the Mishkan out of something that's potentially not kosher, which would be a problem. So now we're going to be given three options for what it is, and then and then a fourth fact about it. Okay. We'll see. It looks similar to the previous one, but it's different. So we're going to skip the first part and then go to the second paragraph. Okay. So you would like to read the dispute? Somebody hasn't had a chance to read yet. Would like to go for it? Buckbeak.
Rabbi Elazar asked, "What is the rule about
the second paragraph?"
Okay. This is a dispute between Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Nechemiah, and the rabbis. Rabbi Yehuda said the tabernacle cover was made from tanin, and it was named after its color. Rabbi Nechemiah said it was galat kinin, and the rabbi said it was a type of kosher animal that lived in the wilderness. Rabbi Hoshea said it had a single horn. Again, okay. We're back to the single horn theory.
Right. So between the two Gemaras, so now we have some more facts about it. There seems to be a debate as to what it is. So options include, again, it could be any or all of these elements. We see that now there's a color. It's made out of the color of it was this color called tanin, which we're going to figure out what that is. Or the color called galat kinin. Like one of those two colors is what it was, not necessarily an animal even, just like that's the color of the perhaps the animal, perhaps not, but again, that's the color of it. And then we have the rabbis who said that it's a type of wild, kosher wild animal that lived in the desert, which would fit with the description that we just had in the previous Gemara we read. And of course, we have Rabbi Hoshea again saying that it's got a single horn. But as we see, there seems to be three or four possibilities for what the animal is. Right? We have it being many colored. We have it being two distinct colors. We also have the option of it having a horn, and we know that it's kosher. Right? That's what we have. But it seems like you could pick and choose because it doesn't seem like all of the Tana'im mentioned here all have the same opinion. It seems like they're actually in dispute. So it could be that any one of those might be the determining factor. It's unclear. So now let's start. So now that we have a little bit of background, let's try our first round at what is a tafash. So our first guess is going to be that based on the commentary Korban Eda from the 18th century, he says that it's a hyacinth blue dyed leather based on the fact that the word tanin is used in the Sefer Aruch to describe a type of blue dye. So that's what he's saying, based on the first opinion that we had. Yeah, let's go back here. The first opinion we had here of being tainted. Then we have another option that it's a galat kinon, or the galat zainon, which is an ermine weasel. Okay? So, or Dene, right? That is this opinion is saying that we line up the second opinion that we just mentioned with the previous one from the other Gemara, and it basically looked like the type of, it would look like this nice, cute little animal. This is what it, this is the, this is the, again, it's not this animal, but it has to look like this. It has, the hide of the animal has to look like this animal's.
They just had that on Jeopardy tonight.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Oh, if you had it before, you could have won thousands of dollars.
I know.
Okay. So
a horn. He doesn't have a horn.
Correct. It doesn't have a horn, right? So the thing is, this one isn't the right animal, but it looks like this animal potentially, right? That's another one of the, that's one other option. That it looks like the animal, not that it has a horn like this animal. Okay, so that's, so again, the only problem with these explanations for being this type of weasel is that, well, A, that's not kosher, and not definitely not a desert animal. So we're a little stuck because this is an animal that lives in a wintry climate. So, and as far as calling it a die, so it sounds like the Gemara is very much, again, except for that one opinion in the Yerushalmi, the rest of them seem to say that it's a living animal, not just a die. So it's, we keep seeing what it is. Here now there's a, now we have a Midrash Tanchuma which describes it as well. Okay, which we're going to see is another way of describing what we had before. So this is Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Okay. So again, somebody like to read this version.
I'll read it.
Thank you, Ralph. Go for it.
Okay. Rav Shimon ben Lakish said, there was a large kosher wild animal in the wilderness, and it had a single horn in its forehead, and its skin was six colors. They took it, and they made tapestries from it. Can I continue, or?
That's fine. The next one was a repetition before about how it was miraculous, and then disappeared. So this would indicate that, again, this definitely sounds like it's a wild kosher unicorn that had six colors. I don't know of any animal nowadays that has six colors. And right, means that it's like colors of the rainbow, right? Every color is accounted for. And they made a wonderful tapestry out of it. So, but again, they don't. The Midrash finishes up by saying how, well, it was miraculous, this animal, and it doesn't exist anymore. So, but again, we're looking at the fact that it had one horn and had many colors. So now we're going to try to say maybe it's not literally many colors, but that it looked from a distance many faceted, and therefore it could be a single color, but it could still fit the bill. So now let's look at some of the options. Okay, so one option is it's a narwhal. Why would we want it to be a narwhal? Okay.
Got a single.
Right, it's a single horn. Right? This is a single horn. It's got a lot of different colors. It looks kind of strange. Right, so this is a theory first put forth by zoologist Israel Aharoni. So he argued that that was because that it was this narwhal just entered the Arctic. It would explain why it was such a rare feat for it to have showed up once and never again, because this animal isn't supposed to be in the Mediterranean Sea. It's supposed to live where it's very cold. If it showed up, you know, and beached itself and said hi to Moshe, we're very confused as to how on earth it wound up in the middle of the desert. So also we see that its hide is very colorful, you know, the nice different spots. So again, might not have six colors, but again, it does look like it has many colors. And also the Arabic for whale is the term tuchush, which sounds a lot like tachash. But the only problem we have is, well, this is definitely not kosher, right? Whales are not kosher. They might look cool. They might look leathery, but they are most definitely not kosher animals. So that'll also lead to being a problem. So now we're going to start throwing out a lot of options. I apologize for the speed. It's just that we're trying to get through a lot of fun creatures and a lot of possibilities. So again, if anybody has any questions on it, feel free to chime in. Let's get to it. So one is the option is Ibn Janaf in the 12th century. It says it just means tanned leather. Following in the first beginning of the Yerushalmi, so that would also, so therefore there's nothing to see there. Similarly, we have Rabbi Sadegon, as well as Rabbi Avram and Rambam, who said it was a type of black leather. Again, based on that your solemn opinion, which would again which would look nice, but it wouldn't help us to find the real animal. Okay, now another option we have is where Pinchas Horowitz in the 19th century suggested being a zebra. We've got the possibility of an antelope, suggested by Rabbi Ludwig Lewinson as well as Rabbi Shimshon Frel-Hirsch. Apologies for not showing all the pictures of these. I'm pretty sure that these are all fairly standard zoo animals, so they don't deserve their own pictures. There's another option is a giraffe. I see I froze. One second.
You're great. Now you're frozen.
I see I froze. Okay, so I'll. Okay, so again. So we had the antelope by Rabbi Ludwig Lewinson, as well as by Rabbi Shimshon Frel-Hirsch, because these are animals that again have both nice long horns on the top and are relatively colorful. We also have the giraffe, which is another option, because giraffes are both kosher as well as they have horns, albeit small horns, and they are very colorful. Another option is that of an okapi. Which is an animal that looks halfway between a zebra and a giraffe. Okay, other options are a dugong or a porpoise, based on the fact that as mentioned before, the Arabic of Tahash is small whale, so they figured let's try other small whales that might fit the bill. And because dugong, porpoises, seals, and whales, and dolphins are all a little more common than Mediterranean, so maybe it's one of those. Another option is that people have translated it as the badger, which is based on a mistranslation, so I'm not going to give you more on that one. And the last option that is given by Dr. Stephanie Daly is that of colored beadwork based on the Akkadian word duchtu, which almost sounds like tachash if you say it really fast. So based on that colored beadwork and the fact that we mentioned that it was an item that went on the shoe, so we thought maybe that is what a tachash is. But as you may see by this really large list of tachash, as well as the fact that Gemara was super confused as to whether or not it has been in existence since or not. So any or all of these are potential options for the tachash. The one that's seemingly most radical and least is the one with the colored beadwork, because it's neither an animal nor anything directly to do with leather. It's simply an adornment to go on top of the leather. So, but again, that is one of the that those are this is the range of the opinions, and hopefully we'll be able to keep going through and be able to see the other animals as well. Okay, so again, that was the tachash. Okay, so then the next animal on our list is the re'im. Okay, so this. Oh, I see that the English isn't up. Yeah, here we go. So what is the re'im? So this re'im is we first see it in terms of the blessing that we're given by Bilam when he's trying to curse us. He explains how God brought them out of Egypt and he brought them through the Tawafot of Ra'im. Deliberately, completely mistranslated that one. Did not translate that one because we're going to have to see what it means. Okay? And then also we see that it's also the Ra'im is central to the blessing that Moshe gives to the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Yosef, where he says, B'chor shoro hadarlov, k'nei Ra'im karnav. So the horns of the Ra'im shall be, right? Like the firstling bull of his majesty, he has horns like the horns of the Ra'im, and he gores the peoples and the ends of the earth, one and all. So right now we see that, so this would, all this would seem to imply that the Ra'im is one mighty beast with a fierce horn or two, and that is busy goring, that is quite scary and gores things. So, but as far as what that is, well, that's nowhere near enough information. So things that are worthy of mention is that you may have noticed that in the, at least in the second verse, that it goes along with after having mentioned a shore, right? We just mentioned a bull, and then we mentioned the Ra'im, right? So they seemingly are, so there's potential to have them being related animals, which we'll see factors in, right? So maybe they're related in that sense. So, well, So the issue is that Rashi and Unklos think I'm wrong. They say it simply means tofot ra'im does not have anything to do with an actual animal. Rather, it simply means the highest expression of God's strength. So that would mean that I'm wrong. Sorry, but don't worry. Fortunately, we have the Septuagint, which was translated by the 70 Sakenim, the 70 sages, under the decree of Ptolemy in the 3rd century BCE. We actually fast for the fact that this occurred, but as a result of it, we have translation in Greek as saying the glory of the Monochorus. Paul does not bring the Greek. I just simply don't know Greek. So,
all Greek to me.
Yes, it is. But as far as I can pronounce it, but I wouldn't make it. But so then again, monochorus, as far as what does that mean? So hopefully people are, so mono means one and koros means
horn.
So what do we get?
Horny guy.
So we get a unicorn, right? Which is also why Rav Sajagon translated it as a karkadon, which was the Arabic word for unicorn. They seem to have that word. Of course, unicorn, we've never found a true unicorn that exists in the sense of, you know, a horse with a nice horn across its nose. And so as I'm sure people are thinking, that's not it. But what we have found is this thing called a rhinoceros, which was suggested by Avraham Chana Yagel when he says that he saw them bring, when he was living in Italy, they brought in from Africa, they brought in a rhino. And he referred to it with the term as the ra'im. But similarly, we have the case in the Latin Vulgate, which also translates it as rhinoceros as well. So here's our, again, with that was translated by Jerome, when he was translating from the original Greek Septuagint into Latin, which was actually considered his translation of the Septuagint was considered to be canonical in the church for many years until they decided to switch over to English. For more on that, that's something in Christian history, so we'll leave it where it is. Okay, again, rhinoceros. As you can see, rhino, nice big nose, right? Got a horn on it, so that could be it. But there's only one. We're gonna have an issue with that. Is that it appears that this animal, at least other parts of Tanakh, seem to indicate that it is kosher. And as far as and the rhino is most definitely not kosher. As we see here from Yeshayahu, right? The Lord has a sword to save with blood and is gorged with the fats, referring to various korbanot, the blood of lambs and he goats, kidney, fat of rams. The Lord holds the sacrifice in Bozrah, the great slaughterlands of Edom. Wild oxen shall fall with them, young bulls with mighty steers, and their blood shall be drunk with blood, their soil shall be saturated with fat. Here's the translated as wild oxes. Again, whether or not that is right or not, we'll leave that again. So again, when I said wild oxen, that means that that word is ra'im. Sorry about that. I missed that in the 106 translation, right? So the ra'im is wild oxen in here, but then we mean ra'im, right? Because there's young bulls and then there's ra'im. So are they related? Right, so seemingly everything here mentioned here is a kosher animal that would be slaughtered by God ritually, and this nevuah of Yeshayahu. So now the question is: so now that we have this that we know that it's kosher, so that means we have to rule out the rhino because rhinos aren't kosher. They don't chew their cud. They don't have split hooves. Therefore, they're not kosher animals. Sorry, rhino. Now we're going to try for some other options. Okay, so another option is the oryx. So in case you're wondering, can we find an oryx nowadays? The answer is, well, unfortunately, they went extinct in 1627. So a reason why this would be a good argument is that, well, one is that the word for ra'im in Assyrian is rimu, which sounds very similar to ra'im. Oh, wait a minute. I have another picture of that. Okay, fine. Never mind. Okay, so, right. So, again, oryx is a large animal. It's the ancestor of the modern, of the domesticated cattle. it was roughly a foot taller than the tallest breed of cow that currently exists. And its horns, as you can tell, are quite long and quite imposing looking. So it was. So it's a distinct possibility that the aurochs could have been it. In fact, as far as people, worshiping the power of an aurochs, so they have found depictions of an aurochs in cave drawings dating back to, what was it, the 7th century, 7th millennia BCE, I think. Basically, for thousands of years, people were very impressed by aurochs and drawing about them, and they thought they were really cool, as well as being really big and scary at the same time. So again, these were not domesticatable, and they eventually went extinct from overhunting. So that is one option, the aurochs. Now there's another option, again, it's aurochs. Remember, it is because this aurochs looks like it's an ox. Not to be confused with... Oh, wait, sorry. So the next thing is that we see from here, this is a midrash, which would seem to indicate that it's not supposed to be... Well, we just thought just now, I thought it worked well because, as we mentioned in the times that it's mentioned often along with another bovine with a strong ox. So I say that this is a bit stronger than an ox, even more impressive, would have made a lot of sense. But we have this midrash into the Sifrei commenting on the Bechoros Shero Hadrlo, which firstborn man's ox, grandeur is his. It says that it is that our Ra'in is not powerful and mighty. Right, we know that oxen are powerful and mighty, so clearly the Ra'in is not powerful and mighty. So if it's not powerful and mighty, what is it? It's something else. It's the Ra'in. And what does that mean? Right, again, horns of the Ra'in are more impressive than that of the ox, that of an ox. And so Rashi Gaon says that it's the oryx, which in Arabic is rim, which works quite well. Again, it's got the resh and the mem, the m. Right, the same letters, RN, right, the same consonants. So we make a lot of sense. As far as what an RX looks like, for all those who have seen them before, that looks, again, as far as the horns go, those definitely are some mighty horns that you're saying that, oh, these horns are fancier than an ox's horns. They most definitely are fancier and way more impressive than the little horns that your standard ox happens to have. Okay, so summarize our section on the Ra'im. So the Ra'im is a mighty beast. Options of what it were, we had potentially that it wasn't even that it was some sort of unicorn, but that didn't help us because we don't know what that is. Then we went for some actual real live animals. Options being the rhinoceros. Then we said that's not kosher. Let's try again. We got to the oryx, which is looks like it very well could be. As we mentioned, it works well with the imagery quoted in the Pesukim of Tanakh. The only issue is that there is one pasuk midrash in Sifrei that are used. But you can say that maybe the Sifrei there's different opinions of Chazal, and so you don't necessarily have to follow all of them. So that's why we have different opinions. Some say so there's the aurochs, there's the aurochs, which is this is a wild animal. Most definitely not domesticated, but again, it looks quite majestic and has very scary horns. Okay? All right, we still got time. We're good. Okay, great. Okay, so now we're going to move on to the next section, that of the koi. Okay, so this next pronunciation is debatable, but we're going to go with the it could be koi, could be kawi, could be kavi. Depends on the caveat that you had and who punctuated it. Because it's not a verse from the Torah, we do not have as strong a tradition as to how to pronounce it. So we'll call it like koi, but again, it's not a koi fish, it is something else. Okay, so who would like to read about the koi? Okay, go for it, Moshe. I froze.
frozen.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry about that.
Okay. Akoya is in some.
Okay,
sorry
about that.
There we go.
Okay. I don't know what happened there. My Zoom just reset itself. Okay. Okay. So we're continuing on with Akoy. Okay. Hopefully we'll be no more technical difficulties.
All right. Here we go. We got it. Akoy is in some ways like a wild animal in the terms haya. In some ways it is like a domesticated animal, behema. And in some ways it's like a behema and a chaya. And in some ways it is like neither a behema nor a chaya. And how is a koi neither like a behema nor like a chaya? It is forbidden because of kilayim, to yoke it with either behema or a chaya, which is a Mishnah in Bikur.
Right. So there's this weird animal that we can't peg down. Is it a domesticated animal? Is it a wild animal? What is it? It's somewhere in between. So this would seem to be not a big deal. Right? We just should have point at, it should be easy to find. But it's a debate even in the time of the Gemara, what exactly is this animal? So here we have, this is a Gemara in Chulin, where we have several different options for what it is. Okay, so here we go. So who'd like to read this Gemara?
Read it.
Okay, thank you, Ralph. Go for it.
The Gemara notes that this dispute is like a dispute between Tanoim cited and the Ebraisa. The koi is a wild ram, and there are those who say it is that which results from the mating of a goat and a doe. Rabbi Yossi says a koi is a distinct entity, and the sages did not determine whether it is a species of undomesticated animal or a species of a domesticated animal. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says it is a species of domesticated animal, and the members of the house of Duche would raise flocks, and the flocks of them as with other, and I can't see the rest.
Okay, right. Domesticated animals. Okay?
Yeah. But okay. I can't. Yeah, okay.
I guess my screen sharing isn't working so well. That's okay. So,
get off.
Right. Okay. So there's four options we have. So there's some sort of wild ram, which we're going to have to figure out what that is. Uh-huh. Okay. There's a crossbreed between a goat and a doe, right? So that, again, domestic, common goat that you may see, and a doe meaning some sort of a female deer, right? So some form of forbidden animal that's crossbred. And then Rabbi Yossi says it's something else that we just have no idea what it is, that the sages could figure out what it was. And Rabbi Chukalel says, what are you talking about? I've got a flock of those over there, right? My friend raises them. I don't know what your issue is. So as you can tell from here, it's gonna be it's already a debate. Which one is it? So now let's try getting into. We have four options. So now let's try and see what are some of these options look like. So one of them is that of the Rebbe Elchananel. Gives us the first option. He calls it a gamus, which is a water buffalo, which is something that hopefully many of us have seen before. Again, this is not the American buffalo, which is way more impressive. But it is the water buffalo. So this is again borderline cattle, borderline wild animal, and therefore that's why you'd say this is a koi, because it's almost a cow. It can breed with a cow, but it's not a cow. It's also not quite a wild animal. So because they kind of are really boring and just kind of like eat grass and walk around all day. So all right, so. Understandably why you're not sure, is it a wild animal or is it a domesticated animal? Because it's smack dab in the middle to begin with. Okay, so now the next option we have is some modern scholars, such as Dr. Grzowski's and Yellen, who says that it's a bubalus, which is when you look at it, you're like, this looks like another type of buffalo. The answer is they are genetically related. But again, this is more of a this is a much wilder form of animal that is much more violent, found in Africa than the water buffalo, found in more of European type climates. So, right, which is both a plus for it, is that, oh, see, you've seen that more easily. But on the other hand, they're also like, yeah, but it's quite clearly, as opposed to the water buffalo, which you might think is basically a cow with slightly longer horns, this one is a little more violent looking and has different temperaments. Therefore, it is actually more closer to being an actual wild animal. So, therefore, right, so that, so again, so the, as, so again, by this, this whole part we're discussing about what a koi is based on an article by Dr. Mordechai Kislev. So, and in that, so again, he disqualifies it because he's fairly certain that this suggestion of Bubulus is definitely a chaya. Okay, so now let's get rid of those and let's try again. So now we have a person, Yehuda Felix, who suggested that it is a mouflon. I definitely mispronounced that. Okay, basically it's a wild sheep native to the Kashmir region from eastern Turkey, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Iran, which is, some say, the ancestor of the domesticated ram, which would work very well when we say Ayil HaBar, right? We mentioned the being a wild ram. So if you wanted to say what is the wild ram, what better wild ram is there than the literal ancestor of the domesticated ram? So that's Professor Felix's opinion, right? Again, I can't say any of these are wrong because that's his opinion. Then the last one we have is by Rabbi Alexander Kohut, who says it's an antelope picta, which is a, where you see this antelope, which is kind of a, doesn't look like a standard antelope. It looks almost, it's like, it's kind of stuck in between a bunch of different animals that you normally would recognize. You're like, I don't know what this one is. You're like, I don't know, is it a deer? Is it a horse? Is it a cow? Is it, or is it somebody made a mistake when they were at the drawing board? So that also is a fairly reasonable animal. Again, that it is a kosher animal. Just the only issue is that we can't really tell what on earth it is because it could go this way or that way depending on how you wanted to push it. Okay. Now, next we have the shamir. So the shamir is a fantastical beast known for its ability to chew through stone like nothing and to split it quite easily. We will read through the Gemara here. We're just discussing what the shamir did. Again, we are not going to discuss the story of Ashmedai and how he and how King Solomon managed to trick Ashmedai to showing what the shamir was and how to find it. That story can be found in the Gemara and Gittin. We don't have time to do that because that story in and of itself would both guys have to lead us back to our previous year on demons, and we would not have time to cover all the material. So here we go. So shamir. Who'd like to read? We have three paragraphs, so feel free to unmute yourselves or raise your hand and let me know if you would like to read.
The Mishnah taught, from the time when the first temple was destroyed, the shamir ceased to exist. The sages taught, this shamir is the creature with which Solomon built the temple, as it is stated. For the house, when it was built with the stone from the quarry. Now these words, should they be understood exactly as they are written, that King Solomon took the whole stones and shaped them by having the shamir do the cutting. This is the statement of Rabbi Yehuda. The Braita continues, rather, one writes the letters on them in ink and shows them, that is, he places the shamir close to the ink markings from outside without having it touch the stones. And they split open the lines of the ink of their own accord, like this fig that splits in the summer without losing anything of its mass. And like this field in the valley that cracks in the rainy season without losing anything of its mass. The shamir was used in this way for these engravings. The sages taught, this shamir, its size, is that of a barley corn, and it was created in the 6 days of creation, and nothing hard can withstand it. And what is it kept? so that it will not break everything in the vicinity. They wrap it in tufts sifkin of wool and place it in a leaden vessel, itanai, full of barley bran, which is soft and will not be broken by the shamir.
Okay. So we have two functions that the shamir is used for, and we have a physical description. So what it's used for and why it's important is because it was a manner in which you could cut stone as well as engrave on the precious stones of the choshen, the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, without actually use of anything metal or without causing any damage to the stone or the, whether it be the hard stone or whether it be the precious gem or the stone, it'll cut it without anything else happening to it. Nice clean cut, perfect break. Awesome. So based on this, right? So again, so this would be a very hard one to find, because it's like, how would that work? In fact, again, it says in the second description, it doesn't even need to touch it for it to be able to do so. And then we have the question of the size, right? We have the being of that size of a barley corn, again, which is pretty small. And then we say that nothing could withstand it, and it has to be contained in wool, barley bran, and a leaden vessel. Lead was the strongest metal known at the time, which was often used by the Romans for a lot of things, which of course was bad because lead leads to lead poisoning. They didn't know that at the time. But right, so again, that's what you was required in order to make it. To handle it, it was very intense, very strong. So, based on this, what could the shamir have been? So, here's some of the options listed. As you mentioned in the first line, right? The first option is that the shamir was used to build an edition and disappeared. So that's one opinion. Another opinion is that it could still be found. So we're operating within the opinion of. Not that there's a miraculous a creature that showed up once and disappeared. Rather, it's a creature that, in theory, we could still use. Okay. So now, what are some of the? I see. I went out of order. Okay. So we'll go with last first. One option, which is the most radical one, which we'll do first, is that of the opinion of Emmanuel Volonovsky. He was a scholar. He lived in the 20th century. He passed away, I think, 30 years ago. Or maybe it was 4 years ago. Anyways, so he suggested that it was a radioactive substance. Why did he think that? He thought it was a radioactive substance because, let's head back to the previous one. He thought it was a radioactive substance because it eventually ceased to exist, which he interprets to mean that it lost its potency after it had been used to cut the amount that it began to cut. He says that radiation is a likely candidate because it can cut without actually touching anything else. And he also says that it's possible because storing things in leaden containers is something that we know is done for radioactive materials so that it won't actually, you know, leak out. And therefore, that's why that was used. The only problem with that theory is that that means that the shamir isn't a living item, which is the assumption that is made by many other Gemaras, that it is a living creature and being. So, while yes, it may fit some of these descriptions here, it still has the problem of it not being alive. Unless something has radically changed and we started treating those as alive. So another option given, if it's a real item that currently exists, is something called Theobacillus concrevitoris, which literally means conquer eating sulfur rod. We are not the prettiest of names, but again, that is a bacteria here, which can cut through literally anything by eating it in the hardest of rocks. The only issue being, we said it had to be the size of a barley corn, which is something that we can all see with our naked eye. As you see here, that is 0.5 micrometers. Or sorry, is that nanometers? I think this is a newer. It's really, really small. It's definitely not visible to the naked eye, even no matter how good your vision is. So Therefore, that one, so that would be a problem. And also, there's other, so again, if you can't see it, then it's really hard to maneuver it, how to use it if you don't know, if you can't see it being there. So another option we have is the type of desert snail, the Eucondris. There are three of them that grow in Israel. So here's an example of the desert version of it. So you see here, right? Here's a picture from multiple angles, right? And you can see its nice teeth here that it can cut through and eat through stone. The only issue with this is that as opposed to the Theobacillus, which could cut through basically anything with strength, this is limited to limestone. So it's not, so then that would be quite helpful in terms of the depiction we had of cutting the stones to the base of Midash, but it would not help engraving gemstones because limestone is one of the weakest of stones and almost all gems are much harder than limestone. So we'd be a little stuck with that one. But there's another option, which is that of the Chiton, which is another creature. Look at here, which has some of the hardest teeth. This teeth made of the hardest naturally growing substance called magnetite, which can basically eat for anything. But the only problem is, again, I apologize if this is a little nauseating, this photo. There were worse ones. I tried to pick one that looked the least strange. So the only issue with that is that, well, as you can tell by the hands holding it, you see that's the one over here, is that it is most definitely much larger than a barley corn. So therefore, not necessarily either.
Maybe in those days, barley corns were that size.
It could be, but that seems to be like, it's possible, but botanically unlikely because we've never found any of this type of creature that large. Yet it could be, just we haven't seen it. So as far as identifying this to be that one, it's hard to do because we simply haven't seen it. So I guess so for options for the Shamir, again, we often think of it as being some sort of worm of some sort. So again, so these all do kind of look like people call it worms and they can eat through. But again, an issue with all of these also is that they do, as we mentioned, the magic splitting that we had in the Gemara, right, where it splits with no residue, right? It splits it straight in half by putting it over it, not necessarily in. So that would be an issue. So again, so as far as Shamir is nowadays, as opposed to when we were mentioning the previous animals where we had a fairly good hunch, we might know, this is one where we're like, yeah, we just don't know. And that's fine because there is very well possible that as was the case with the Tahash, that these were animals that existed and then disappeared and they only existed for a short period of time that God miraculously created. And if so, it is perfectly understandable how they could have been here today and then gone the next day. Okay, and hopefully next week we'll be getting into the topic of Leviathan and Behemoth. We will be discussing both the potential for their what they would be identified as nowadays, as well as discussing some of the more interesting parts of how they come in stories of the end of days. So if anybody has any questions, please ask them all. If there's any particular topic you'd like me to cover for next week within the topic of Behemoth Leviathan that you'd like addressed, please email me and let me know.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.